On a cold December evening in 1956, two sisters went to see their favorite movie for the 11th time. They were going to the local movie theater to watch the film and eat snacks like they had done 10 times with that movie, but many times before that. After leaving the theater when the movie was over, the girls would never be seen alive after encountering a monster. In the month and a half since the movie Love Me Tender was released, Patricia and Barbara Grimes watched it 10 times. The two sisters, ages 13 and 15 respectively, adored Elvis Presley, and the movie was his first debut in a Hollywood film. After the excitement of Christmas wore off, the two girls decided they wanted to see the movie again. They made plans over lunch on December 28, 1956. Barbara was working part-time in a furniture store, so she went back to work to finish out the day, while Patricia went home. Despite Patricia being younger, she was a social butterfly, always laughing and joking around, while Barbara struggled with her shyness. She was trying to work on being more outgoing at her job, and it seemed to be helping. After Patricia got home, she got an excited call from her brothers, Jimmy and Joseph Jr. At age 11, Jimmy was the baby of the family and Joseph was just 1 year older than her, so they were all close. The boys had been shoveling snow for a bit of pocket money, and that morning they found a $10 bill on the ground on their way home, the equivalent to just over $100 in today's money. The Grimes family lived in a busy neighborhood in Chicago, so there was no shortage of places to explore within walking distance, and they wanted Patricia to come out and have fun with them. When Patricia met up with her brothers, they went to Angelo's restaurant to get banana splits and play songs on the jukebox. Then they went shopping. The boys bought candy and Patricia bought some Elvis comic books for her and Barbara. Patricia got home a few hours before Barbara that night and had a dinner of tuna casserole, mashed sweet potatoes, and a chocolate chip cookie, but she didn't eat very much after her earlier adventure. When Barbara got home, she ate dinner as well, and they both got ready for the movie. Both girls put bobby pins in their hair and bobby socks on their feet, and put on several layers to keep out the cold. The girls didn't have to be up early for school, so their mother, Loretta, gave them $2.50 to cover bus fare, tickets, and snacks, and told them to be home at 11:30 p.m. Loretta had been a bit nervous about letting the girls leave since it was going to be a cold night, but they were going to be close to home and it was winter break after all. They were going to the Brighton Park movie theater, which was a short bus trip away on Archer Avenue. As they were preparing to leave, they were horsing around a bit and knocked some ornaments off the Christmas tree. They had to catch the bus though, so Loretta sent them off, telling them she'd fix it. They left the house at 7:30 p.m. They met a friend named Dorothy and her 6-year-old sister, Jeanette, and got some snacks at the theater. Though they undoubtedly had the movie memorized by that point, Barbara still wept when, spoilers, Elvis died in a shootout at the end. But Patricia managed to hold back her tears. The movie was a double feature with another film, and Dorothy was not as interested in the second movie, so she left partway through. That was around 10:30 p.m., and she did not see anyone else with the girls when she and her sister left. When midnight struck and the girls weren't home, Loretta knew something was very wrong. She sent Joseph and his big sister, 17-year-old Teresa, to wait at the bus stop for them, but 3 buses passed without any sign of the girls. Loretta called the police just before 1 a.m., but they told her the girls were probably just staying out a bit later than they planned. It was Christmas break after all. Shirley Wojciech, the eldest daughter of the family at 30, came over to help. The siblings had another older sister named Leona, but she'd passed away just 2 years prior from an illness. Loretta had been extra protective of her children ever since. After a few hours of checking in with everyone they could get a hold of, they decided they need to get the police to take them more seriously. Shirley drove Loretta to the police station and they convinced them something was wrong. Police listened that time and began searching, and when they failed to find them that night, they started to take things more seriously. There had recently been three boys around the same age as the girls murdered in the same area, so police were moving with some sense of urgency, but also putting considerable resources into exploring the theory that the girls may have been runaways. Teresa was supposed to take Patricia shopping that day as an early birthday present because she was technically going to turn 13 on New Year's Eve. The family didn't think there was any chance the girls would have run away so close to Patricia's birthday. Loretta and her ex-husband Joseph had been divorced for years, but he joined the search right away. The Grimes family started canvassing the neighborhood themselves, handing out flyers with the girls' information. The next several days brought in a flurry of sightings of the girls that all seemed to contradict each other. A bus driver who knew the girls in passing swore they'd gotten off at a bus stop near their home between 11 and 11:30 p.m., while a clerk who worked at the theater claimed they were hanging out there until at least 1 a.m. The 28th had been a Friday, and one man swore the girls asked him for directions near a park Saturday morning. Someone else said they saw them at a train station Sunday night. One of the first leads the investigators looked into was the possibility the girls had run off with sailors. Apparently around Thanksgiving, they met two sailors at a movie and brought them home to meet their parents. Just a few days before their disappearance, Patricia told a friend that she'd gotten a letter from a sailor who said he was going to be in town for the holidays, but the men were investigated and cleared. Loretta received 8 different ransom notes that all ended up being from the same person who suffered from mental illness. A few others came in afterward, and police took them more seriously and even went to Milwaukee at the direction of one, bringing Loretta to do an elaborate ransom exchange in a church, but no one showed. Police canvassed an area of the city with 20,000 buildings, knocking on doors and searching old buildings where they could. Though they were hoping to find the girls alive, they searched drainage canals, railway yards, and shanty towns, too. Police were also on the lookout for similarities between the Grimes case and the murder that had happened the previous year. In October of 1955, Robert Peterson and two brothers, John and Anton Schuessler, all boys between 11 and 14, vanished not far from where the girls disappeared from. They'd also been out to see a movie, albeit at a different theater, and had never come home. Their bodies were eventually found in the Robinson Reserve Woods Preserve after an extensive search. But a few sightings pointed towards a less morbid theory. In just the prior month alone, police had picked up over 50 teenage girls from all over the country who'd run away to Memphis to try and see Elvis. When police caught the missing girls, they'd drive them around Elvis's home, then take them to the bus stop to go home. Two people spotted the Grimes girls either headed to Memphis or wandering the city, and the sightings were deemed credible enough that the police slowed their search. On January 19th, Elvis himself spoke to the media to say, quote, "If you are good Presley fans, you'll go home and ease your mother's worries." But the girls still didn't come home. Just 3 days later, tragedy struck. Leonard Prescott was driving on a service road near his home when he spotted what he thought were mannequins. I'm not even going to say it. But when he got home and told his wife Marie, she insisted they go back to make sure. The road was pretty much only used by people who worked or lived nearby, and if they didn't report what they saw, it could be a long time before someone else did. They drove back and got out of the car, and there they learned the hard way that it's never a mannequin.
Damn it!
Leonard had to carry his wife back to the car when she saw the bodies. Police were fairly certain the bodies were the girls they'd been looking for, but they had to be sure. They called Joseph to the scene, and he positively identified his sisters. The cold had preserved them well. They called Loretta on the way to church. She stopped and went to her neighbor's house to be consoled. Joseph Sr. and Shirley soon joined her and then took her home. The media was quick to show up and ask for a statement. They photographed Loretta wailing as she said, quote, "My poor babies, why couldn't they have taken me and let my babies live?" In the days that followed, though, the press was somewhat helpful in giving Loretta the platform she wanted to chastise the police for not believing her that her girls hadn't run away. Had they started investigating when she first called, who knows what would have gone differently? Police processed as much information as they could at the scene before anything was moved. The bodies were only about 5 feet from a nearby road, and both were nude with no signs of their clothes anywhere. Only a few feet further into the woods was a culvert with a stream called Devil's Creek. Had the bodies been thrown into the water, they wouldn't have been found until spring. That had police theorizing that perhaps whoever dumped the bodies was spooked by an oncoming car or had wanted the bodies to be found. Wounds and discoloration on the bodies had police theorizing at the scene that the girls met a violent end, but the wounds were all later determined to be from scavengers post-mortem, except for a small puncture wound on Patricia's chest and a scratch on her arm. The discoloration that police mistook for bruises was from the cold. With the bodies found, police had a suspect right away. On January 15th, Walter Kranz had called police from a liquor store. He'd worn a knit cap and tried to keep a low profile and make the call anonymously, but police were able to track him down. During the call, he had told the police, quote, "The Grimes girls are dead. Their bodies are in Santa Fe Park. I saw them." That was only about a half a mile from where the bodies were found a week later, and though police searched the area, they didn't find the bodies then. They'd questioned him a few days prior, but thought he was just another kook. But with the bodies being found so close to where he'd claimed he'd seen them, they needed to question him again. Upon further investigation, police found that Walter had been skipping work several times between when the girls vanished and when the bodies were found, and he'd been telling his coworkers it was because his wife was sick. In reality, he and his wife had been separated for some time and he was living alone. When grilled about why he knew where the bodies were, he told police his family had a history of psychic abilities, and the visions of the bodies had come to him in a dream. Eventually, he recanted that, blaming it on a drunken delusion, and tried to deny he'd ever said anything about psychic powers. After police checked his handwriting against various ransom notes, they had to let him go. He said he was going to pack up and leave town because his reputation had been ruined. Meanwhile, rangers and police worked together to process the scene. The bodies had been found in a small wooded area known as Willow Springs, but just a bit south was a 500-acre nature preserve. The snow was up to a foot deep in certain spots of the forest, which complicated things. Police focused on shelter houses, culverts, and trash cans. Rangers did a broad search for anything visible above the snow line in the woods. Forensics combed over the area where the bodies were found with magnifying glasses, picking up every bit of trash, no matter how small, in case it could be important. Police were trying to focus on finding clothes because the clothes of the boys in the Peterson Schuessler slayings had never been found. There were other disturbing similarities as well. For the boys, the bodies were stacked on top of each other crisscross, and the bodies of the girls were stacked that way as well. Anton's body had parallel striation marks that police theorized were from his corpse resting on a rubber mat. One of the girls had very similar markings. Though with the triple slaying, the boys had been beaten and strangled, and with the girls, the cause of death was not immediately apparent. One similarity the police were trying to avoid having with the triple murder was political infighting about the case. That investigation had been bogged down by different departments arguing, and there were entire days of the news cycle devoted to describing departments fighting and accusing each other of messing up the case. They were trying to work together better on the Grimes case. Sheriff Joseph Lohman was heading the investigation. Coroner Walter McCarron was in charge of pathologists running the autopsy, and Harry Glows was appointed chief investigator for the coroner's office and was meant to be a sort of liaison between the two. Initial findings soon informed the public that the girls had died of exposure to the cold and that there did not seem to be any signs of sexual assault. Due to the cold weather, it was not immediately apparent how long the girls had been dead, so they needed to run more tests to figure that out, but while that was happening, police found a promising new lead. A local cabbie reported seeing the girls on the 30th with a man who had sideburns and a passing resemblance to Elvis. Police tracked down the man, who was named Benny Bedwell. He was 21 years old and was a bit of a drifter. At one point, he'd traveled with the circus. The owner of the restaurant he'd been spotted at corroborated the story that he'd been there with the Grimes girls on the day in question. After several days in police custody, Benny signed a statement in the early morning hours of January 27th, confessing to the murder of the Grimes sisters. He said that he and an accomplice he called Frank met the girls at a tavern on January 7th and wandered the city for several days in the area around Madison Street, known as Skid Row. Skid Row was made up of taverns and bars selling cheap booze and motels that could be rented by the hour. Benny said that he, Frank, and the girls had been on a bender for several days, drinking and having sex at various shady hotels. Then, on January 13th, they were cruising around in a car and getting drunk when they stopped in the Willow Springs area. The men wanted to have sex with the girls in the car, but they said they weren't in the mood. Then they all started fighting and the men ended up knocking the girls out. They stripped off their clothes to get rid of the evidence, fearing they might have killed them, and dumped them on the side of the road. They figured if they were alive, they could flag down a car for help, and if not, they'd gotten rid of the evidence. Loretta, the girls' friends, and their pastor all doubted Benny was guilty from the start. Patricia was only 13, and Barbara was too shy to talk to strangers and cried at cheesy movies. The idea that the girls had a secret double life where they had drunken benders and wild sex with strange adult men was laughable. During Benny's inquest, Loretta, Shirley, and Teresa all went to sit with Benny's mother to comfort her, assuring her they thought he was innocent. The very next day, the funeral was held. Two rosaries blessed by the Pope himself were shipped over from Italy. The funeral was paid for by donations from the city and even some from across the country. Other donations paid off the family home as well as created a reward fund for information. The media was relentless at the funeral. They trampled over other graves and were generally disruptive, not afraid to bother the family with questions at the most sensitive moments. Funeral goers were not shy about bumping into reporters and refusing to speak to them. Reporters photographed Loretta resting her head on Patricia's coffin and saying, "My Petey," over and over again. Between watching the family cry, they quizzed Loretta about Benny's statement. For some reason, the names and addresses of all the pallbearers were published in the papers, all of whom were the girls' classmates. Several of their families got calls after that their own daughters would be kidnapped and that they would never see them again. As all of that was happening, more and more information from the autopsy and investigation was contradicting Benny's confession. The autopsy tests determined the girls had died the night they vanished, as the food in their stomachs and intestines matched exactly what they had eaten that day. The restaurant where the girls were allegedly spotted with Benny had been canvassed on January 2nd, and the owners said at that time that they were sure they hadn't seen the girls. They'd only decided they'd spotted them later on. Benny had been there on a double date with a friend not long before the girls vanished, though. But the girls he was with were Native American, they were both adults, and really the only resemblance they bore to the Grimes sisters was that they all had dark hair. With the Bedwell lead possibly going nowhere, police began investigating the angle that teenage gang members had killed the girls. Roger Maynard, a 19-year-old bank clerk, came forward at the end of January to say he'd seen the girls the night they vanished. He'd sat behind them and was able to recount word for word a short exchange the girls had with Dorothy between the movies, so police found him credible. At 11:15 or 11:30, Roger got up to leave and the girls left as well, walking behind him. They walked a similar path down the street, and Roger turned around when he heard a car come to a quick stop behind him. He saw the girls giggling and talking to whoever was in the car. It was a Buick early 50s model. Roger stopped to look into a store window, and the girls passed him on the sidewalk, all while talking to the car following them slowly. Roger then got a look inside the car and saw it was driven by three teenage boys. The girls talked and giggled a bit more before the car drove off, and the girls headed in the direction of their home. Roger's story would later change to say that two cars stopped to talk to the girls, the second one being a black Ford Mercury. But whether that was him changing his story or the media misreporting it the first time is unclear. The sighting of the black Mercury does match several other sightings that night, though. That night, a Black Mercury had been stolen from a dealership nearby, and several people reported suspicious activity in a car of the same make and model. Three teenage boys were seen driving a Black Mercury on the night in question. They tried to crash a party in the neighborhood near the theater, but they were turned away. Police eventually found them and determined they lived near the Grimes sisters, but couldn't find anything to tie them to the scene. A different account was reported by a truck driver who saw two teenage girls wearing similar clothes to the Grimes sisters get into a Black Mercury on the night in question. The investigation into the car stalled while police were fighting to keep Benny in jail. Sheriff Lohman was convinced he did it and didn't want to follow up on any other leads. But eventually, Benny was cleared and released in early February. The autopsy determined the girls had died within 5 hours of leaving their home, and Benny had been at work that night until 12:30 a.m. After his release, Benny said he had only confessed because of the police mistreating him. He said they barely fed him, didn't let him sleep, beat him, and vaguely threatened to turn him over to the other guys who they said would really hurt him. Eventually, they promised him that if he confessed, he would get off with only disorderly conduct, as he hadn't meant to kill the girls. With the investigation heading in a new direction, the coroner's office held a press conference to clear up details of the autopsy. The chief pathologist, Dr. Jerry Kern, said that the case was incredibly baffling. He said he had never before worked a case quite like it, where it was clear there was foul play involved, but no signs of a violent struggle. Both girls had frozen to death. One theory posited was that the girls had been hanging out with other teenagers and had perhaps ended up somewhere with a walk-in freezer, where they had been locked in as a prank and then just left to die. But there were no injuries indicating they'd struggled to escape anywhere. Police also considered the theory that the girls were being held captive somewhere without heating and that their killer hadn't realized how cold it would get. Pathologists said they believed the killings could have been sexually motivated, but they could find no evidence to back that up. They stressed that both girls appeared to be virgins. Days later, Harry Glows, the man who was meant to help police in the coroner's office cooperate, came forward with shocking information that contradicted the coroner's report. He held a press conference in his own house and essentially told the media that the coroner's office had been lying about everything. He said there was lab evidence indicating Barbara had been molested and that it was possible Patricia had been abused as well. He said he'd studied the weather patterns and was sure the girls had been killed and dumped between January 7th and 13th, which conveniently backs up Sheriff Lohman's story that Benny might still be guilty. The next day, surprising no one, Harry was fired and Walter McCarron held his own press conference. He reaffirmed the theory that the girls were killed the night they died. There had originally been some confusion because Patricia's stomach was empty, but they'd managed to find traces of banana in her intestines. Also, Patricia had been on her period when she vanished and had been on her period when she died. Irregular periods aren't unheard of, especially in the teenage years, but it would have been an extraordinary coincidence. There was also a lot that pointed to Harry Glow's twisting the evidence to pin things on Benny. Harry was in the room when pathologists were first going through the stomachs and thought they had found meat and cheese, but later identified it as tuna and potatoes. Conveniently, Benny confessed to feeding the girls hot dogs and cheese sandwiches right before they died. However, Walter McCarron did finally admit that there had been evidence of sexual abuse of Barbara. Sheriff Lohman would later say they'd found evidence of molestation on both of the girls and that Walter tried to hush it up because of religious reasons, which may have some merit. Though investigating officers at the time said the information was kept secret to weed out false confessions, Walter contradicted that. He told the media that it was wrong for the public to know because it would distress Loretta, and even though the girls were in heaven, having others know about the sexual assault would be a burden on their souls. Sheriff Lohman went on to deputize Harry Glows, and the two kept investigating Benny on their own. But other detectives moved back to the teenage gang angle. Two separate groups of four teenage boys with gang ties were investigated and cleared. Another group of three that knew the sisters tangentially and had talked to them on the 27th were investigated and cleared. One man reported seeing girls who looked like the Grimes sisters being dragged into a car on the night in question. He received numerous death threats and police had a guard on his home. Two teenage boys were questioned and investigated for other sexual assault charges, but could not be tied to the Grimes girls, and their names were withheld as they were minors. Someone sent a letter with a black rosary and a sock to the Grimes family home saying they'd seen a teenage boy frantically cleaning out his car, then driving off after he discarded the items. But neither girl owned a black rosary, and the sock was a very common style. Because police were looking into teenage boys in the area, they revisited a sighting that had been reported to them early on. Edward Lorden and Earl Zastro had been driving around that night and saw the girls playing in the street just blocks away from their home at around 11:30 p.m. They said Patricia was running up ahead of Barbara and hiding behind doorways and buildings to scare her. The boys knew the whole family well, and Loretta believed their account, but it had gotten lost in the flood of sightings those first few days. However, because police were heavily investigating the theory teenage boys had killed the girls, they decided these boys were suspects and would randomly pull them out of school and harass them. When the snow thawed, police searched the woods again. An article of clothing was found in February and tentatively identified by Loretta, but what it was exactly and how it was found was kept secret. Other leads went nowhere. Someone sent Loretta a letter saying they killed the girls and wanted to confess, and bizarrely dated the letter 1997, 40 years in the future. A box containing human flesh and hair was found, but did not match the girls or any other current unsolved cases in the area. Okay. Police arrested a homeless man squatting in a building on Archer Avenue near the Brighton Theater when they found bloody women's underwear in the same room as him, but he said the blood was from pigeons he was eating. Tests came back and it was indeed pigeon blood. Definitely not what I thought would be one of the weirdest details in any of the cases I've covered. In a city as big as Chicago, there was no shortage of horrible crimes in the following months and years, and because the Grimes case was so well known, police were always looking for connections. In August of 1957, 15-year-old Judith May Anderson was shot and dismembered. When reporters went to interview Loretta about the Anderson murder and possible connections, Jimmy was wrestling with his nephew, and Loretta said they would just need to talk over the boy's antics because, quote, "this house isn't a morgue." She talked about the importance of paying the most attention to your living children because they need you more, and she encouraged other families mourning similar losses not to let their grief consume them. In November of 1957, William Stacy, a 23-year-old baby photographer, killed a 16-year-old mother named Darlene Todd in a homicidal rage that he said he couldn't explain. He was a friend of Benny Bedwell. He'd actually been questioned during the investigation into Benny, as there was a problem with amateur photographers tricking young girls, as young as 9, into posing nude under the guise they would become models. Apparently the mother, who again was only 16, had her robe fall open by accident while he was photographing her baby, and that enraged William because it, quote, "offended his modesty." He was caught because he left his business card at the scene of the crime. Though he would be locked up for killing Darlene, police couldn't link him to any other crimes. In September of 1958, 15-year-old Bonnie Lee Scott was killed, decapitated, and left in the woods. Charles Melquist would eventually be found guilty, and police investigated him for the Grimes sisters as well. In his home, Charles had the names and addresses of several young girls, two of whom lived very close to the Grimes sisters. The day after Bonnie's body was found, someone called Loretta to say they'd committed another perfect crime. Loretta thought the voice sounded similar to a caller who'd called her in May the previous year and told her that Barbara had an unusual deformity on her feet where two of her toes were crossed. No one, aside from immediate family, knew about that. The caller had said he helped undress the girls and that he knew who killed them, but he didn't say anything helpful. He seemed to delight in taunting Loretta. He then made a vague threat that she needed to, quote, "tell that skirt to keep her mouth shut and stop giving information to the police or you'll find her body floating in the river." That threat baffled both Loretta and the police. Though the lead seemed promising, they were never able to find anything to link Charles to the call or the murders. Loretta dealt with hundreds of calls in that first year, and though the number dwindled, they didn't stop. For a time, someone was just calling her as well as Bonnie and Judith's parents and just breathing heavily into the phone. Someone else was calling Shirley at her home just to remind her her little sisters were dead. The months turned to years, and in 1959, on the 3-year anniversary, Loretta told the papers that she still gets at least one call a week about the case, either someone claiming to have information or someone taunting her. More bizarre and strange suspects would come forward in the following years, but none brought definitive answers. Leon Clifford Weber, described in the Chicago Daily News as, quote, a Bible-quoting former mental patient with a long record of sexual crimes against children, was a suspect at one point in 1960. He'd been institutionalized after attacking his own mother and had at one point assaulted a 7-year-old girl in the woods near where the Grimes girls were found. There was one suspect named Jack the Clipper who was buying locks of hair from young girls on the street. Interestingly enough, he was not the only one caught for that particular offense. There had been another suspect who both stole locks of hair from young girls and had a psychic dream that the bodies would be found naked in the woods before they were actually found. That meant Walter Kranz wasn't the only one having premonitions. A man claiming to be a sailor at a bar told a stranger he'd picked up the girls but wouldn't admit to killing them. Two separate suspects who pretended to be police officers were investigated. One died of a heart attack after he kidnapped a girl, and another vanished. One of the more promising suspects was a man named Barry Cook, who was arrested in 1958 and ended up serving a sentence of 9 years. He'd been arrested for assaulting several women, slashing their stomachs, and then stealing their money, and he attempted to sexually assault one of the women. Both during the initial investigation and during his incarceration, police tried to connect him to several of the unsolved murders in the area. They described him as a violent sadist, and they were certain he'd committed other crimes he hadn't been caught for. The Chicago Daily News said, quote, he has a tremendous ability to see in the dark and is all but insensitive to bodily pain. Apparently, the police inserted a needle under his fingernail to test his reactions, and he didn't even flinch. When asked about the murder of Margaret Gallagher, he said, quote, I wouldn't do anything like that, would I? He certainly seemed like someone capable of murder, but police could never link him to anything else. The 90s would bring about another promising lead, perhaps the most substantial since Barry Cook. An investigation into a string of arson fires, among numerous other crimes associated with horse racing in the area, would inadvertently bring police back to the Peterson-Schuessler murders. They were investigating Silas Jane, a notorious criminal who owned a horse stable in the area, when an informant told police that Silas had actually helped cover up the murder of 3 boys decades earlier. One of the employees at the stable, Kenneth Hansen, had picked up the boys hitchhiking and asked if they wanted to see the horses. He started molesting the boys, they fought back, and he killed them all. He apparently told several people about it, but they were all involved in criminal activity, so they didn't report it. The trial was a mess, but Kenneth Hansen was eventually sentenced to life in prison and died in 2007. The stable he worked at was near where the Grimes bodies were found, but Kenneth had only been caught soliciting boys before the murders and didn't seem to have an interest in girls, but perhaps he just never got caught with them. Kenneth was not investigated for the Grimes sisters because the trial had been so messy that it was hard enough to even convict him for the murder of the boys due to the botched investigation. James Hennigan, a retired Chicago detective working on the case now, claims there might be evidence Kenneth was at the Brighton Theater the night the girls died, so there might be something there. In the past decade, the case of the Grimes sisters has seen a resurgence. A Facebook group is providing new ways for old witnesses to come forward who may have been lost in the initial flood of reports. Multiple retired detectives and officers are dedicating their time to trying to find new leads. It's possible with enough evidence, the bodies could even be exhumed and DNA samples compared to Kenneth Hansen or any of the other suspects barring legal red tape. As recently as 2022, WGN-TV in Chicago did a deep dive of the case and talked with Teresa, the only remaining survivor of the girl's immediate family. As the case approaches its 7th decade, more and more people who knew the girls directly won't be around to see answers if they're ever found. But with every year that passes, technology only grows more and more advanced. Perhaps someday, maybe even someday soon, the case will finally be solved. We can only hope.
If you're the victim of domestic abuse, please reach out to someone for help. Please talk to your local shelter or call the National Domestic Abuse Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-7233. Or you can go to thehotline.org to chat with someone online. This website is set up so that, at any time, hitting the escape key twice will take you to a Google search page. That way, if your abuser is nearby, you won't get caught seeking help. If you're having feelings of harming yourself or someone else, or even just need someone to talk to, please contact your local mental health facility. Call 911 or call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline by simply dialing 988 in the United States. They're available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and will talk to you about any mental health issue you may be facing. If you are a member of the LGBTQ+ community and suffering from discrimination, depression, or are in need of any support, please contact the LGBT National Hotline at 1-888-843-4564 or go to lgbthotline.org. Thanks so much for letting me tell you this story. If you enjoyed it, subscribe on whatever platform you're on, hit like, rate us, or leave us a comment. You can check out our other show, Somewhere Sinister, on YouTube or anywhere you listen to podcasts. If you'd like to support the show, check out our merchandise at thisismonsters.com. The link is in the description. Thanks again, and be safe.